You are listening to the podcast That's Life in Sweden, or as we say in Swedish, Sånt är livet i Sverige, with me, your host, Lisa Orsimäki. I want to welcome Australian author, Chief Executive Officer or CEO for an organization called Women and Children First, and who has extensive expertise in public health and sexuality. Gabrielle Morrissey, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm well, and thank you for having me.
Oh, look, I'm so looking forward to having you on the program and hearing about your ideas and thoughts. So to start off the conversation, who is Gabrielle Morrissey?
Oh, that is a multi-layered answer, I think. But essentially, I was raised by an American father and an Australian mother, grew up traveling the whole world in the Foreign Service, and so grew up with this sense of global connectedness and social justice. And that really piqued my interest in, you know, equity and rights and women's rights, because we spent a lot of time in Asia. And I got interested in the 80s in sexuality and women's legal rights to reproductive freedom. And it was the era of HIV. So talking about healthy sexuality and safe and safer sex is really what launched my career. And then and I've been a sexologist and relationships expert, so to speak, for 32 years. And that has spanned from healthy relationships to unhealthy relationships to abusive relationships. And then now I'm the CEO of a domestic and gendered violence organization.
Wow. Wow. Now, what I'm finding interesting, you actually completed a PhD from Curtin University in Western Australia in 2001 that related to health sciences. What was it that made you, first of all, interested in doing a PhD and the area you decided to specialize in?
Well, there are a number of PhDs in my family, and we have a strong value in education, and my brother also has a PhD. I've been very interested since a young person in the ideas and research generation that comes out of universities. So I was really interested to look at a research question and study it in depth and have a PhD come out of it, and hopefully it wouldn't be some dusty textbook thesis on a shelf and would actually have some practical use. I was also really interested in the experience. Various things led up to doing a PhD, including my master's degree in human sexuality education, which was really born out of all that HIV prevention work that I was doing and safer sexuality education. And I was interested in the lack of sex education in Australia at the time, which I can say, sadly, two decades later, is still a serious lack, and wanted to investigate what young people thought about their first time experiencing some sort of defined intercourse, and whether it was a negative experience or a positive experience based on if they'd had any rehearsal or prior learning or formal education or parental education. So I really looked at that, and I narrowed it down to female sexual experiences and behaviors and perceptions right in those teenage years to see what their experiences really were as a phenomenon. I used the methodology of phenomenology and looked at all of the elements that make experiences good and bad. And of course, you know, all the stories about alcohol and pressure and lack of consent and coercion and all of that came out. And people were quite surprised that all of that was present at really young teen years. And this was 25 years ago. So from sort of being interested in women's rights and reproductive rights as a result of growing up in Asia, and then teaching sexuality education, I really was looking at my PhD through a feminist lens of what aren't we doing enough of to prepare young women to stand in their own agency and authority to be able to, A, demand safe sex for themselves and insist upon it, but also to demand pleasure.
Yeah.
Because pleasure was just never part of the conversation. It was about, you know, don't get pregnant, don't get a disease, don't get an infection, don't get, you know, sexually assaulted, all of these fear-based messages without any message around pleasure. And the backdrop to this time, I'm not sure about how much through Europe, because I wasn't in Europe at that time, but in the US and Australia, Sex and the City was a revolutionary television show still in its early seasons. So adults were starting to have conversations in their living rooms about pleasure and sex, but it did not translate down to young people. Mm. And really, honestly, it still hasn't. But that's where I really got started.
Mm. Did you write a book as well called Urge?
I did. I've written three books. And at the same time as my PhD, I wrote Urge, and basically meant I did nothing in my life except write and research.
Wow.
Because that book ended up being around 500 pages, and each document, the PhD thesis and the book, very different, but similar lengths. And so I just sort of doubled my workload in agony.
But, you know, I love the title, because when I'm thinking about just what you have been talking about, and when it comes to girls, young girls, and our education about our own sexuality and the pleasures that we can actually enjoy sexuality, it has never been spoken about as girls or women can have urges. It's basically more, well, how I understand, I haven't read the book, but for me, I just love the title, the title and the idea. And that's why I'm curious. When you talk about urge, are you talking about women's urges, or are you talking about men's urges?
Well, that book, Urge, is sort of like a all about everything to do with sex, and it includes all sexual orientations and all genders.
Right.
So what that book was not just for females, but there is a lot in it about equality of pleasure, because I was so driven at the same time by this devastating unveiling, really, of these girls saying, no, there was not any pleasure. There was not any conversation about pleasure. I didn't even know how to bring up my own pleasure with a partner.
Hmm.
And, you know, many had never experienced an orgasm, but also didn't really experience deep desire, sexual desire and arousal with their partner, because of either alcohol or drugs shutting down their system physiologically in their responses, or it being a negative experience that they really weren't doing for themselves as much as they were doing it for their partner. There were lots of reasons. And they were reflecting back with sadness and some regret, not always regret, but just this idea that they wished it had been different. So that was really what I was getting at. What would have made it different for you, knowing what you know now about those early years? And they said, take the pressure out of jumping straight into intercourse and, you know, lots of naked genitalia, and slow the whole process down with lots more pressure-free exploration. And then they would say, you know, but in a heterosexual context, boys are never going to do that because they're always pushing and pushing and pushing. But if they had education around the benefits of slowing down, because by pushing and pushing and pushing, we know that rapid ejaculation, or what used to be called premature ejaculation, happens in 1/3 of teenage and young men.
Yeah.
Because they're rushing through the process and then developing a quick reflex, if you will. Mm. But we don't talk about this idea of pleasure and slowing down to our young people, because so many people are afraid that if you talk about anything positive to do with sex, they're just going to go out and do it. Yes. And we're going to have a lot more unintended consequences.
Yes.
And that's the fear. But the reverse is true. And it's been shown for decades that if you empower them with information, particularly really practical information around making decisions and how to communicate, how to ask for what you want, even specific ideas around how to direct your partner to pleasure so you're not acting and faking, then you can... they slow the process down because there's so much more information to deconstruct and then practice. But that message is a tricky one to get through to society and to parents.
And it's, you know, that should be to both girls and boys. And but
absolutely,
we'll,
both girls and boys.
So we'll talk about that a little bit later. But that, I know you have a podcast, or you have a title, and you titled your podcast The Divorced Sexologist. What made you start the podcast?
When I split and started the process of getting a divorce, I was really inundated with everyone's secrets. They would come forward and say, you know, I'm in a really miserable marriage too, but I just don't think I can leave him. Or, what did you fight about? Because we fight a lot. And do you think it's normal, or do you think I'm in a bad relationship? And and I realized it really wasn't a forum that felt safe, where people could relate or figure out, should they stay, should they go? Is this a fixable relationship or an abusive, really shouldn't stay, it's detrimental to my health and safety? And on top of that, so it's a place to talk about sex and divorce and all the different transitions in life. But on top of that, I was a relationship expert getting a divorce, which is bad press. And yet the process of getting divorced, of realizing divorce was the best option, and then on the flip side, being divorced, taught me so much about just me personally, about walking the talk and having your boundaries and not making excuses for yourself or your situation or your partner, that no, this behavior is out of bounds. And this is not the behavior that I saw in the beginning, but somehow we've had this slide and we've just let it slide, and I've let it slide and I haven't called it out. And I've learned also about how to be very, very independent and very happy as a divorced person and a single person. And that really goes against the tide still.
Yes.
In a world that drives us into being coupled, and not just coupled for a few years in our reproductive peak, but for life. And we applaud couples, to some degree we should, because it really is remarkable that are married 40, 50, 60, 70 plus years, but the majority of people just are not. And so then they feel like a failure if they're single or single again. And I just want to destigmatize that. I am a very happily divorced woman who's also an expert in relationships, saying it's okay to destigmatize divorce. You made choices that are right for you at the time.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it is such a complex, because there are, exactly like you said, there are a lot of people who are together, I never understand, why are you together, when it's so obvious that you're actually not good for each other. It's not a partnership collaborative partnership. But, and I'm thinking about my own parents, you know, when they hang, you know, my mother stuck with my dad because of the kids, for the sake of the children. And I used to think that was bizarre.
Yes. And it's actually borne out in the evidence that that is not the healthiest way to raise children. We know the healthiest way to raise children is to have a non-toxic, productive, loving, healthy environment. whether that has one or two parents. So if you have two parents, but it's dysfunctional, toxic, destructive, and damaging, staying together in that dynamic is worse than the child going back and forth between two happy parents who are split up. We know it just takes one happy parent to be a better model for future generations and their own love dynamics moving forward than to live in a fragile, very difficult environment for them and not have a loving relationship modeled for them. So this idea that we stay for the kids is historic. And again, the pressure around the family unit, there's also still a lot of pressure to stay and be coupled.
Yes.
And then of course there's finance. A lot of people do make decisions to stay together because of financial concerns. Divorce does sort of divide the estate in half. There's a lot of conflict that then shifts from within the marriage to post-separation conflict, usually around money and childcare and trying to be on and co-parenting on the same page. So they really weigh up which set of battles do I want and which set of financial constraints and trade-offs am I willing to give up.
Yeah, you know, that's really interesting. But what I'm finding more interesting today is that we do have women who actually, and here in Sweden, it's really funny because a lot of young girls, they see themselves as homemakers. And, you know, we have feminists here in Sweden who are going like, what? And you know, and I'm thinking, my goodness, where does that come from? Where does it come that, you know, it has it got, you know, and I'm not sure it cannot, you know, I'm saying to myself, no, this is not right. It certainly cannot come from parents or women. But who knows? I don't know. But it is, I find it's really interesting. And of course, even today, I can imagine in Australia, like here in Sweden, there are women who are proud gatekeepers of patriarchy and who believe that women should be homemakers. What's your take on that?
It is interesting. I agree with you on that. And it's also, baffling and head scratching, confusing. I am a feminist myself in the sense that I believe in equal rights, equal gender rights. And I also believe that women should be free enough to make their own choices, whatever those choices are, that it's an independent individual free will choice, whatever they want to do. If they don't want to pursue higher education, if they want to be, you know, part of this trad wife, traditional wife, homemaker, next chapter evolution, if they want to be feminists and radical political activists, everybody should have that choice. If they want to work and then stop working when they become a mother and then return to the workforce, all of these things should be, in my view, free choice on a level platform. My concern, who am I to judge if somebody wants to stay home and support the relationship from that point of view that they're investing in the relationship and they feel valued for doing that? My concern is, do they feel equally valued and are they treated as equally valued in their relationship year after year in that role? Do they have an equal voice? Because historically, women have not. If they don't earn the money, the buck ends up stopping with the person who makes the money. They have like a veto power.
Yep.
And that's not equal. And then when we really see that emerge is when there's conflict in the relationship, they're at odds with each other, they need to seek counseling, and they may split up. And then there's no equality. The person who has the ability to make the money has improved their career over time, has all the investments and access to all the bank accounts, usually railroads over the spouse that or the partner that it was at home investing in a way that kept her, usually her life, kind of on pause in terms of the external world and her ability to keep up with technology and prospects around working and being able to psychologically shift to working part-time or full-time to then, you know, live independently because you're splitting up. The options become so much more limited. And this is where I wonder, do you really feel equal? Do you feel that you are being invested? And do you have some sort of prenuptial agreement that it's all going to be equal at the end when it shakes out? That's my concern.
Exactly. And then it's the concern, how are you supported by society? Is there a welfare system in place to support you?
Yeah.
Is that, you know, some of the consequences that we know today are that a lot of our women, they lost their homes, they are couch surfing. And I am concerned when young women say, I want to be a homemaker, and without realizing the actual consequences of what does it mean. It's not only about being equal in the relationship. But this is about what would happen if something worse was to happen to you, my partner.
Yes. Oh, it's appalling, the systems and how they let women and families down right when they need the support because they're going through a split or their partner has died or is incredibly sick and can no longer work.
Yes.
But, you know, frequently in split, because that's when the animosity really grows and the system expects there to be child support. But of course, child support's not paid. There's 1.68 billion with a B dollars of unpaid child support in Australia alone. And it's a fairly small country. People don't pay child support. The women do lose their houses. And if they don't have a steady work history, then they can't get a job. If they don't have a job, they can't lease a house, let alone buy a house.
Exactly.
If they've been prevented from understanding where the income that's been earned in the family is invested and they haven't been really across that, which many aren't, they just kind of go, this is my role and that is his role, and they're incredibly unlearned and ignorant about what their personal tied up finances are and aren't. I can't tell you how many times forensic accounting unearths money that was disappeared and hidden just months and weeks before a split, or right when the affair was discovered, or right when he decided to leave. And it's because they're focused on their self-preservation. They have the knowledge and they know they're going to hire a lawyer and she's not going to be able to. She's the one that's going to be on legal aid on the back foot constantly. Because you let the power go in the relationship, and equality really needs to include lots of different aspects of your relationship, not just who does the childcare and the domestic chores.
Mm.
Both of you need to be involved in the finances in particular.
Mm.
Money's one of the biggest reasons people actually divorce, and money's the first thing that people fight about in divorce and as they're preparing for it. So to not have both partners across finances really just then defaults the power usually to him. We also have so many circumstances where they're both on the mortgage, but only he's on the titles of the properties.
That's right.
It's
scary.
Phenomenal. Yeah, it's called economic abuse, and it's opportunistic by some men to do it if women just turn a blind eye. Then, you know, some men are genuine and decent and say, look, this is where our investments are and let's review this, even though you don't want to know, I want you to know. But many men are not like that.
And that's, of course, comes back to the education, and women should be educated on those kind of issues, even if it meant before they married. They want to get married, but, you know, oh no, I'm so in love, you know. I trust him and whatever. And of course, it can go the other way too. So men, you know, with women who are really well off. But we will get a little bit more into that, because now I'm interested in your work as a CEO for Women and Children First. So can you talk about the work of this not-for-profit organization?
Yes, I'm really, really proud of this work. It's an organization that is 49 years old. So that's both remarkable and also awful that for 49 years, it's been doing the same work year in, year out to help women leave domestic and family violence and abuse, and then take the steps needed to then live independently and safely. So that's the core of the business. We specialize in women who leave with their children, so who become single mothers, and we help them with a lot of family support and education and psychological support and counseling, because they're expecting to leave and go into a very supportive system. But actually what happens is they experience post-separation abuse from their ex, and they experience systems abuse from patriarchal institutions that just keep letting them down, starting with family court and then all the way through to retelling their story 8 to 10 times every point of the journey, from the first police report forward to the counseling, to the caseworkers, to the family support worker, to the children's caseworker, to the court advocate on their behalf, to, I mean, over and over and over. We don't have a good system that's trauma informed. Housing is a major issue. I believe that it is absolutely wrong that women, when they report to police or wherever they're reporting to, could be hospital, could be a GP, could be a friend, that they're in an unsafe situation. And I don't mean physically unsafe alone. I mean coercive control, economic abuse, psychological, emotional, verbal abuse, that they're in an abusive, unsafe, basically intimate terrorism is what we call situation at home. That the expectation is that they should flee, and that he gets to stay home in his modus operandi, nothing changes, status quo, hire a lawyer, and of course he's on the front foot. Meanwhile, she is trying to find a place in a refuge that's always full, has, like we just spoke about, very limited ability to get a lease. Because even if she has a job, her financial circumstances on a lease application have changed. Now yes. She's separated. Yes. And so that's perceived differently by agencies. She's got to navigate family court with childcare, all on the move, figuring out systems and forms, and if she's qualified for crisis payments, dealing with the shock with the children, and having to explain everything. It's incredibly stressful. The reverse is what needs to happen. She should be able to go for a night or two or three. There should be a dedicated domestic violence court where she can explain with the police statements and the DV counselor or caseworker saying, yes, this is what's occurred, this is the record. And in that interim time, when family court takes on the case but hasn't decided yet, the temporary orders should be she and the children have the right to return home, because that's in the best interests of keeping the children stable.
Yep.
She wasn't at fault for making the home unsafe. He was. So he should have the burden of being moved out, trying to find housing, trying to figure out how to commute to work and continue to live life in the unstable part, because he made the home unsafe, so he shouldn't have the privilege of staying in the home. So I just find that in itself is absolutely backwards, because there's no accountability and then there's no deterrent. A lot of men would think twice. They may still behave the same way, but over time they would certainly think, hey, if I do that, I'm going to lose my house.
Yes.
I'm going to get kicked. I get moved out of my house. I better either get help or talk to a friend or let's go to counseling, or there'll be always a portion of men who are never going to listen. But there are a portion of men that actually would want to get help if they knew that there was a real consequence to not. Well, it's so complicated, and I think if anybody had cracked it, we would have helped move the needle on men killing women and men abusing women in Australia, at least. And we really haven't. The opposite's happening. It gets worse every year.
Yes.
I spent a decade, and you can hear it from my accent. I spent a decade in the US recently and then came back to Australia in the pandemic. And I came back with my children and all three of us, and they were young. They weren't even teenagers. All three of us were struck by, they wouldn't have said it this way, but misogyny. And America is not a perfect country. I'm the first to put my hand up and say that, especially lately. But we felt this real shift in gendered language and attitudes here that none of us had experienced before. And I was looking at it through my children's eyes. There's a lot of language use that's slang and derogatory to women, and nobody calls it out. It's just accepted as what they call here banter. We're just bantering, or that's just a joke. And nobody is saying, hey, no, you cannot speak like that publicly or in school, or just really deep early years put downs of girls and women. So that's the first thing that has to change. That there's no culture of speaking out, because then if you speak out, you become sort of on the girl's side, and that makes you then weak and uncool. And then the systems are just awful. There's like the unpaid child support and just a shrug your shoulders. What else do you expect? No real sort of fired up advocacy around it. And there's a lot of macho male culture behavior in all the different culture groups that are present, not just white Australia, but the immigrant cultures that come in also come in with this strong macho culture behavior and attitudes. And so there's nothing really fixing that. But even things like when a woman takes maternity leave, she doesn't earn superannuation, which is like the retirement income that accrues off of your pay on maternity leave, whereas he does, even if he takes paid paternity leave. So he keeps earning this nest egg for later. And even if she's in the exact same position but has, say, two or three children, she's taking 2 or 3 years of financial sacrifice out for her nest egg later.
Absolutely.
And that's just a gendered lens looking at that. That's just patriarchy, boys taking care of boys. And it's so baked in to our attitudes and our assumptions around who takes what roles in the government, even just watching the toxic male culture in Australian Parliament shouting at each other in horrible male behavior, and they're meant to be our leaders.
Yes.
And nobody's calling it out or changing it, and it's just it's everywhere. So trying to get men to care that women are now killed by an ex or current intimate male partner once every 4 days in Australia now, they simply don't care because it's not their problem. They're not being the ones killed.
Gosh.
It's awful. But there's no other way to explain it. Because if they really cared, they'd demand a change.
Yes.
But it's really a lot of silence. It's a lot of shoulder shrugging. Makes me crazy.
So what do you believe needs to be done to end violence against women? And is this really possible?
So my radical response is I don't believe the full end is possible. And I differ with many colleagues on this, because many colleagues do believe around the world believe we have to set the end as a goal, because that's what we're aspiring to elevate better behavior and better outcomes. And I understand that rationale, but I also am just too much of a realist. And we've always had violence. Humans are violent. Men are violent towards men. They're violent towards animals. They're violent towards children. They're violent in their cars. There is violence with men. And so there's always, in my opinion, going to be violence against women. If we can reduce that to just a really negligible amount so that it was way down the list of causes of women dying in the world, that's a success. But it's not the true end because of our human nature. So I don't think that it's possible, but I do think it's possible to radically reduce the number of women killed by men in Australia and around the world. And I see how much huge transformative change we've created in society that we did not think was possible. We did not think we were going to end HIV. We did, and we haven't, but we've nearly done it.
Absolutely.
In particular, in places like Australia, we just did not think we were going to change people's minds, desires, and behaviors, because what we knew how they behaved before HIV and AIDS, we thought was just the way they were always going to behave. But we can see that we change. We can see that we've changed our adjustments around gender and understanding gender. And the younger generations are very fluid with their expressions and their use of pronouns. And we've moved the needle on understanding the definitions of marriage. We've moved the needle on where women work in the workforce, where they are in the military. Like, there are big shifts that we're capable of making. But we have to really focus on it. Everybody has to care. And then the governing bodies have to agree to put funding, attitude, campaigns, and awareness into it. It goes into the education curriculum. It's in public discourse, debate, dialogue, so that that can change. And men's violence against women has just not gotten that kind of attention. There have not been big campaigns in the media. There's a lot of outcry. I get in a bit of hot water when I say it's a little bit like the U.S. gun issue.
Yep.
It just feels overwhelming to change. A part of the culture that there's a resistance to change because it's so big. And they're just so used to critical event, thoughts and prayers. And Australia is in that same roller coaster. And we have to do it a different way. We have to actually have, from the leadership down, actual consequences and actions. Men have to be sent to jail immediately if they're breaching restraining orders and apprehended violence orders. There can't be this sort of, oh, well, you'll go to court in 3 or 4 weeks, and then, you know, you might have to do some community service.
Yes.
That's just, nobody's listening to that kind of consequence. It has to be severe, it has to be swift, and it has to be very uncomfortable for men. And they're not in the business of making themselves or their mates uncomfortable, so it just doesn't change.
What is the Upstander Award?
I'm really proud of this program. We, even though Women and Children First primarily focus on women and children, we don't ignore or neglect, of course, the men and boys. We actually work with men and boys a lot, and we want them on our side, and that's built into our name. Our name is not Women and Children Are Number One. It's Women and Children First, like when the Titanic's sinking. When we're in vulnerable crisis, we need everyone to pitch in to help those at most risk and vulnerability.
Yes.
So our women, children, and domestic violence are in crisis, and they need everyone around them, including men and boys, to step up and help. So the Upstander Award is encouraging that behavior for upstanding character of people who step forward in a crisis, step forward when they see somebody needs help, and stands up for respect and against disrespect. So in our youth culture here, we offer and hand out the Upstander Award in various sports clubs, because it goes along with sportsmanship on and off the field or park. So the coaches look for really good, respectful relationships and communications and demonstrating, leaning in when somebody needs help and being basically part of positive male culture. Mm. And then we also do it in the schools. So through the year, the school administration watches for people who have upstanding behavior, and it's messaged throughout the sports season and in the clubs and throughout the school year as an important value to show, so that we're just trying, instead of saying, don't be disrespectful, stop using that foul language.
Yep.
We say characteristics and behaviors we are looking for, and we're awarding positive reinforcement that when we see it. So it's really just trying to encourage Australians, especially who seem to have a lot of bystanders. They have the tall poppy syndrome here.
Yep.
If you grow a little bit too tall, they'll cut you down to an even size. If you stick your neck out to, not fit in and say, call somebody out, then there's an immediate consequence. So we're really trying to create a different culture where you're not a bystander, you're an upstander, willing to show leadership and respect.
Now, love that. You are not a bystander, you're an upstander. What a great way of putting it. Now, in a study by Westcott from Monash University, found that an increase in sexual harassment and misogynistic behavior against women teachers and girls in schools, with Andrew Tate's influence shaping and reinforcing regressive views on masculinity. What is your reaction to what I just read? What do you think?
My first reaction is absolute truth. Don't doubt it for a second. Completely believe the female teachers have seen and been exposed to young males who are parroting Andrew Tate's attitudes around women and about women myself. So it's awful, and it's taking hold. The power of social media is so strong and immediate that it's taking hold of young men and young boys to a point that no one is off limits. And that comes down to, in part, a respect issue. In my generation and older, you definitely would not have said a word sideways to your teacher because they had power and authority over you. And there was an ingrained, it goes even back to generations before that, where, you take off your hat, if you've got a hat, when you walk inside or in the presence of a woman. That has completely eroded to the other side of entitlement, where masculinity is not respectful and communicative with these sort of symbols and signals of, it's not chivalry as much. I really boil it down to respect. It's, I have an entitlement because I'm a man and that makes me superior. So no matter what your age is, you're a gender of a female, which means I have the ability to speak to you however I want. And that's coming from social media. It transcends race, age, culture, and is all about gender being the most dominant variable. which is why we're seeing students doing it to teachers, because they have this incredible gender entitlement. Mm. And that's so dangerous, because that's the same thinking that gives young boys and men this sense of, I'm entitled to your body regardless of what you have to say about it. And it's not, those are really easy dots to connect if that's the thinking of young men and boys. And it's gone from being unconscious to very conscious
actions. Yeah.
And it's grown up in this vacuum. Social media took over the messaging because parents are working very hard. They're not really sure what to talk about. They're not in tune with their children's worlds. School doesn't offer comprehensive sexuality education on an attitudinal basis, because they think that's attitudes and values should stay in the home. We'll deliver the facts at school. And the parents haven't been aware of all of this information on the platforms that their young kids are watching and absorbing. And so it kind of accidentally flourished. And now it's that genie out of the bottle that's, you know, the size of a dinosaur.
Mm. So when I'm thinking about schools, do they have some role in educating kids about fake news and the dangers of influencers such as Tate, even Trump? I mean, a world former world leader, Putin.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, it seems to me that there is, I don't know how much of a silence it is in schools.
Well, I think, so first of all, in Australia, schools aren't going to do anything if they're not funded to do it, because they're already operating on a shoestring, and the private schools aren't going to prioritize it if they're not made to, by and large. And so it really means that there's very little delivered unless it's made to be a priority and funded. But it's also too little too late. This kind of critical thinking skills in terms of fake news, in terms of watching and looking with a critical lens what you're absorbing in your personal life and your viewing outside of school, that doesn't happen until the mid to late high school years. And yet kids are absorbing messages around cartoons and social media and storybooks from a very, very young age. Mm. And of course, they're not going to be learning critical thinking when they're, you know, in year two, when they're 8 years old. Their brains aren't quite developed to think that way, but they're developed enough to have some time in school questioning it and thinking about it and reflecting back messages and what, you know, wondering and musing. And there's none of that that's done in primary school here. It's, if anything, it's about bullying and stopping bullying behavior. Bullying has come in as an acceptable, much needed topic, but there's almost nothing about respectful relationships or critiquing the lens through which you're absorbing messages from social media and all other sources too. And that's a massive gap that I've been trying to get people to pay attention to addressing for 32 years. And the needle has hardly moved on it, because it just hasn't gotten the attention. Now women are being killed at an even more rapid rate. And there's a lot of press frenzy in Australia now about it. We'll just see if it does its usual cycle of tapering down and not much happening, or if there's a sustained enough outrage to go into actual action backed by federal dollars, which is what really needs to happen and has never really happened on a large scale before. You know, it should be a really loud, resounding, powerful voice, but it's still not. It's piecemeal, and women are still a little bit fractured. They're not a united voice on this, like the women who have the traditional homemaker aspirations versus the radical feminists. And we're hearing it a little bit more and more now, but I think women need to feel, first of all, women have been working in this area for 50 years and basically siloed, basically underfunded, not resource, not listened to. Women have been saying, for example, men need to be part of the solution for half that time, at least.
Yes.
Years, many decades. And we're only just hearing that out of men's mouths on any large scale way right now, this year, out of the prime minister. And they call it a scourge. That's the English word that they use here. Not a word that's used in the US very often, but they call it, it's a national scourge of domestic violence. So that to me says, a scourge is really like a stain, okay, a negative imprint, and, you know, just sort of this shame, really. And so it kind of hides it away as something that, you know, that's really, really bad. We probably shouldn't talk about that. Instead of calling it a national crisis, a national emergency, we need, it's not just what women should do to say enough is enough. They've been saying that loud and unheard. Up and down all through every generation has girls, you know, if we all reflect and go, yep, we were pretty powerful in our 20s and 30s. I remember going to rallies and you can see posters that say, I can't believe my granddaughter still has to march, you know, when I already marched about this 40 years ago.
Yes, yes.
So I mean, it's really in leadership and getting men to stop killing women as opposed to women say, stop killing us.
Yes. And just thinking about that leadership and men's entitlement, I mean, just looking at the USA with the backlash against women's right for abortion.
Yeah.
I mean, what, I mean, it's just, it is, it's something that is totally unbelievable. But my concern always relates to that whatever happens in the US has a tendency of trickling down to countries. Whether it's got to do with the type of leader that Trump was. So, you know, you find that the far right movements and voices and misogynists and all these kind of weird voices seems to become a bit louder than they were before. Whereas, and I think you mentioned that, you know, there was a time when a young man, absolutely no way, would walk into a classroom with a hat or cap on his head, would not be rude to his female teacher.
Mm.
And for it to have changed, it's kind of like, it's sort of, it's a weird change that is been taking place. And so I'm thinking, of course, about women as leaders, and you describe your leadership style as a servant leadership. Can you explain what you mean? And also, why don't we have more servant leaders in our world today?
Well, I think I'll answer the first part to inform the second part. I describe my leadership style as servant leadership because that's a particular style of leadership that is not autocratic and it's not based in accumulating power. It's in using and leveraging what power is available sort of as a conduit through my position, whether that's an actual position like a CEO position or an expertise level, a skill set that I then put for a purpose. And so it's not for my gain, my leadership. The leadership cycles towards a purpose or a mission. And our governments are not set up for servant leadership. They're set up for voters to vote for their platform to, yes, in a sense, serve them. But in order to continue to stay in power, they have to constantly be accumulating power and favor and trade-offs. And it's just a more collaborative approach to leadership. It's a collective mindset that we're stronger together. So I use what power I have to get others on side for the purpose of X, whatever it is. It could be the climate, it could be women, it could be animals, whatever it is. And that's a very different type of mindset. Like being a quote public servant, it really is tied into that, that you are not in it for yourself.
No.
Well, I mean, I might as well be speaking alien to somebody like Donald Trump.
Yes.
It's just not a concept they can grasp. And he on one far, far end of the spectrum, of course, he's a total outlier. But there are many, many sort of towards the middle on that side. You could call it the right side, but men represent that power hungry everywhere. And there are women that have to do that too and do it to play the game in order because they're in that power cycle. And to be a servant leader would mean they would be laughed out of the room, chewed up and spat out. They'd have no leverage. They'd be completely used. So it's a very difficult thing to be a servant leader in a model that's not set up for it. But in the health and human services sector, it's the only way really to be truly effective, because if you try to be a dominant, autocratic, oligarch type person, then you're shooting yourself in the foot. You lose all your credibility and authenticity.
Is there anything that you would like to talk about that you believe is really important that I haven't even brought up?
I think a couple of things. When I think about the whole spectrum from healthy relationships to unhealthy relationships to abusive relationships, relationships don't necessarily have to be just one of those things. They're a long-term relationship, a complex, layered, intimate relationship is going to have times when it's unhealthy. It's not always going to be perfect and in that healthy green zone. And it's a matter of being able to recognize when it's slipped to unhealthy before it can get to abusive. Or if you see that it's abusive, recognizing those red flags and ending the relationship without shame and stigma. That's really, before we talk about violence, it's about that we are able to get out of relationships and see those red flags. We have a long way to go for men and women to recognize what those red flags are. And then I think also that it happens everywhere. Unhealthy, abusive relationships happen everywhere, in every generation, in every country. And if we could just feel free enough to tell someone, or be, if we're worried about a friend, be able to talk to them or a mutual friend, the earlier, it's like anything to do with health, the earlier you catch it, the easier it is to solve it.
Yeah.
And I think that we don't have these open conversations enough, because there is shame, embarrassment, and self-isolation or coerced isolation when we're in a relationship that doesn't feel quite right or is actually destructive and damaging. So we would move the needle a lot if we just took it upon ourselves to have dialogues about the health of our relationships in an honest way, instead of just assuming, oh, they're together, they must be happy. And being able to talk about that would be really important. And then the last point, I think, is we keep saying domestic violence, relationship abuse, family abuse is an everyone's problem. It's a whole of society response that's needed. We've all got a part to play. I mean, these are all the slogans that I hear every day. But what happens when we make it so pluralistic? It's true, everyone has a part to play. is people just sort of go, oh, well, that's not my problem. Yes. They're going to, somebody else will take care of it. So I think it's really not saying that everyone has a part to play. It's you. You have a part to play. Your brother does. Your father does. Your aunt and sister do. Your grandmother can even say and help something, probably knows quite a bit across a lifetime about it. You do. Mm. You have something you can do. Mm. Not just this nebulous everyone.
Mm. Wise words. I haven't even thought about it like that. That was so well said. Very impressed, Gabrielle. Thank you so much for being on the program. And I wish you the absolute best, and I hope I can invite you back later on in the future, and let's see how things pan out.
Would love that. It's been my pleasure. What a great conversation and discussion this was.
Thank you. And you have been listening to the podcast Sånt är livet i Sverige, or in English, That's Life here in Sweden, with me, Lisa Orsimäki. Till next time, take care of yourself and each other. Bye for now.